This episode of Linux Action Show is brought to you by GoDaddy.com.
And by Ting.com. Head over to last.ting.com and save $25 off your first device.
Welcome to the Linux Action Show, Season 29, Episode 3. My name is Chris.
My name is Matt.
Hey, Matt, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You ready for me to tell everyone about the big show today?
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
All right, so coming up in this week's episode of the Linux Action Show, we're going to review the Synology DiskStation DS412 Plus. I have it, the box right here. Runs Linux, and it's got a few surprises in the box. I'll tell you, a few more surprises than I expected to see in a NAS, and we'll try to get to that probably age-old question, is it worth the money?
That's a big question, exactly.
So we'll review that in the second half of the show. Of course, we've got the news of the week. I don't know if you've been following the headlines over the weekend, but there's been quite a bit of hoopla going on.
There's been some discussion.
Yeah, and then we've also some new software packages hitting repo soon that I think you'll want to check out, some nice features. Then in the feedback segment, we're going to help some folks in their golden years use Linux. Not bad.
That's a good idea.
But first, it is our picks, and I'm very, very excited about our picks this week. Both the Spotlight and the Desktop pick is outrageously cool.
Oh, I think you guys are going to be pleased.
One of your favorite apps, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. I was just like, you know.
And we've actually given it honorable mention a few times on the show, but we've never actually talked about it that much. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Well, first, we'll start with our Runs Linux pick this week. This has got to be one of the number one all-time sent-in picks. Every now and then something hits the news, and a lot of people send it in because it runs Linux. We got emails, tweets, several subreddit entries, Google Plus threads, everything.
It's like they're trying to tell us something.
The Navy's newest warship runs Linux. This is the USS Zumwalt, I think is how you say it. Zumwalt. You ready for this one, Matt?
Oh my gosh.
Do you know what the captain's name is?
Oh, say Kirk.
Yes, it is actually James Kirk. It is James Kirk. Yes.
No kidding.
Yes,
oh my god, that's awesome.
So it is a $3.5 billion ship designed for stealth, survivability, and firepower. It's packed with advanced technology. At the heart of it is an operations center in a virtual data center powered by off-the-shelf server hardware, various flavors of Linux, and over 6 million lines of software code.
That is so cool. Yeah. Well, and Kirk will have nothing less.
Yeah, Captain James Kirk. Yes, that's actually his name.
Seriously?
Yep. Yeah, that's his name. So so one of the things that these are being built by Raytheon, and a couple of cool things about this. So this is going back to that data center in a box theory that Sun and Microsoft have worked a lot on. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the reasons why they can – so a couple of things it lets them do is, A – and probably the biggest cost savings is it lets Raytheon build these out of the shipping yard. They can build them back at their headquarters and then ship them to the ship. It also makes them modular.
Yeah, right.
Right. And by using off-the-shelf hardware, mostly IBM Blade servers running Red Hat Enterprise Linux, they have essentially a ruggedized server room in a box.
Now, I'm looking at some orange dangly cords there. Tell me those aren't bungee cords holding that in place. They did actually bolt these things in, right?
It's power. It's power.
Okay, just making sure. I was a little concerned.
The boat will have 16 of these self-contained mini data centers.
Wow.
16 of them.
Whoa.
They're 35 feet long, 8 feet high, and 12 feet wide. The 16 EMEs, as they're called, have 235 equipment cabinets, a.k.a. racks, in total. The EMEs tap into the total ship computing environment that the Zumwalt has. The Zumwalt has its own onboard ship-wide internet. Running multiple partition networks over a mix of fiber and copper, which goes into a redundantly switched network, connects all of the ship systems, internal, external communications, weapons, engineering, sensors, over internet protocols, including TCP and UDP. And they even have a diagram in this Ars Technica write-up.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just crazy cool.
And here's what it looks like when you launch a missile right there.
That's... Now, when you're launching a missile, are you wanting GNOME or KDE? Because, I mean, really, that's what I want to know. It's
XFCE,
like, I can picture now. You got KDE open. It's like, okay, here's the settings. Okay,
you know
I got to go over there. You
I think this is the perfect use case for i3 or awesome.
If I'm launching missiles, I want to do it with something awesome, like awesome.
I just don't want anything getting in the way.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Here's some hatches that open up. They got a good picture of that. And here's a picture of sort of the operations center virtually.
Very mission control.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty cool, pretty cool. And
awesome.
Here's another shot that's over on the PBS NewsHour. And one of the things they're doing is, this is the data center. It's a completely detachable module all
so
itself.
Awesome. Minus the power cords, yeah.
Yeah, they just pick that thing up and they can set it down. It's a 1,000-ton deck house.
Jeez.
Yeah.
How about that?
Boy.
Well, you know, and if you're looking for an IT job, apparently the Navy is a place to consider now.
Mr. Gentoo in our live IRC chat room says that they tried to go with GNOME, but during one of the updates, they removed the launch missile feature from GNOME.
Well, no, it's an extension, right? I mean,
yeah. You just got to be careful after updates.
Just don't confuse it with the one that launches the Nerf missile that you USB into the side of your computer. Right, those are different plugins. Right, you don't want those.
Yeah. And they're right by each other in the plugin list, so just be careful.
Yeah. You don't want to get those confused. You're all launching. Oh, wait, that's wrong.
You know, it's a couple of funny things. So if you didn't know, in the past, a lot of these Navy ships actually ran like Windows 2000 and XP. I know, kind of a scary thought. And also, on a lot of them, because of the power requirements of both the data center and the weapon systems, they would have to shut down the data center components while they fired weapons.
Were they shutting down or were they blue screening? Because that's really what I want to know.
I feel like it was they would analyze, then they would shut down, shoot, and then turn everything back on and then see what happened.
Pray to God it does blue screen, right?
What happened while we were rebooting? So how far Linux has brought us. Goodness. And a big catch for both IBM and Red Hat. So
Yeah, right? That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
And a previous sponsor of the Jupiter Broadcasting Network, UnitySync, was involved in synchronizing a lot of the data between these different ships. Like when they come into port, they'd use UnitySync to synchronize them and go
that's
between all the different
score
databases.
For them there.
Yeah. So pretty cool runs Linux this week, and thanks to everyone who sent that in on Twitter and email and Google Plus and the subreddit. Had a lot of good stuff.
We got the message.
Yeah. All right, Matt, we got one more message to get out there before we go into one of the coolest app picks we've had in a long time, and that is our first sponsor this week, GoDaddy.com, GoDaddy.com, GoDaddy.com. So I was over the weekend, like I almost always do every weekend now, rewatching the entire Jean-Claude Van Damme movie catalog.
Absolutely.
And if you watch it all in reverse, and I'm talking all of it, I think you'll find a secret hidden message in all of his movies. That is, you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Show 199.
No.
Show 199.
Is it like a subliminal message? Is it like tattooed on the back
of his head? Show 199. Show 199. That's all over and over again. Show 199. Yeah, because you can get a .com for $1.99, and that, historically speaking, is one of the most important things that's ever happened to a .com.
Oh, yeah, I would think so. I mean, it's like birth, right?
He is a time cop. Jean-Claude,
this is true.
He's a time cop,
and
right?
And being a time cop, you need to make sure you're getting the best deal possible at all times.
Time cops know about these kinds of things. So go over to GoDaddy.com and use our code SHOW199 when you check out. You'll get a .com for $1.99. Now, additional .coms, $9.99. Additional years, $9.99. That's a crazy great deal.
Works for me.
Right there.
Works for me.
So you can get your first domain for $1.99. Now, Matt, you might say, Chris, what would I do? What would I do with a $1.99.com?
What would I do?
Matt, you could do anything you want. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Okay.
Oh, all right, that's fine. So you know here on the live stream, so the Jupiter Broadcasting Network does all our shows live, right?
Yeah.
And one of the hardest things when you've done a lot of shows is coming up with new titles.
Sure.
It's that's work, Matt.
Oh, it is work.
So what we have done is we have outsourced our title generation to our live chat room. They can suggest. But the problem was is at the end of it, we all go and vote. And I gave out this long URL that everybody
God. JBLive/512
9er G. You're being generous, even to tell you the truth. It was even worse than that.
I could never remember it, and I work here. I mean, it's like, yeah. I have no idea.
Well, we tried doing like a bit.ly short thing, but not everybody remembers the bit.ly thing. So
I have horrible memories.
What I did, I just went over, used the code SHOW199, and I registered JBTitles.com.
Ooh, that now, I can remember.
I don't have to have a server to point this at because it's so simple. At $1.99, why not do it? So then, because GoDaddy has an awesome management panel, I've talked about a lot of the great business class features that the GoDaddy admin panel has, but I just want to show you something that even just an average consumer can take advantage of, and I use it all the time.
Yeah.
You register that .com using the code SHOW199. You get it for $1.99. Then log into your GoDaddy control panel like I have up here on my screen.
Okay.
This is the forwarding. Yeah, all you do is you just say, go in here, update forwarding, and I just say forward to HTTP, and I put the long URL that I want jbtitles.com to forward to. You can see it's jbbot.jupitercolony.com, even :5000. It's even got a special
port. Oh, you get your port, right?
Okay. Now our audience doesn't have to worry about any of that because, and I can say if it's permanent or temporary, and I can say forward, and I can say forward with masking so it even masks the URL.
That's handy.
Yeah, it's really simple, and it updates super fast. And now when people type in jbtitles.com, they'll hit the GoDaddy name server, and it will automatically redirect them transparently to that longer URL. And if I ever want to point it somewhere else, I just log right back into my GoDaddy panel, and I change it. This is why registering a .com for $1.99, you can really use it for anything. You can point it at existing URLs that are just crazy long.
Well, and something I did here recently is I actually moved my hosting over to GoDaddy just because I got tired of being bent over the table every time I had to pay my bill. And the rates are great. And what's cool is if you have domains with GoDaddy already, it's stupid simple to set up your hosting with it. It's like it's already all integrated.
Click, click, Matt.
It's just like, oh my God, I did this a long time ago.
I know. So big thanks to GoDaddy, and take advantage of Jean-Claude's warning from the past. Use code SHOW199 while $1.99.coms still exist. Use them up while you can, folks. And thanks to GoDaddy for sponsoring the Linux Action Show, and thanks to you guys for using our promo codes and keeping them here for a long, long time.
We appreciate you.
Keeps us on the air.
That's right.
All
right,
Matt, let me show you this app pick. Now, everybody out there's probably at least heard of ArmRock, and if you've heard of ArmRock, there's a good chance you've heard of Clementine. Well, they kind of have a shared history, but they're both off doing their own thing now.
Yep.
And Clementine just popped out a new version, version 1.2.
It did, and it's a damn good version.
It sure is. There's a couple of really, really neat things going on in this version of Clementine. So let me just show you Clementine if you're not familiar with it first. You don't have to have 1.4 to take advantage of all this stuff, but a couple of things that I'm going to show you, you might.
Yeah.
So first of all, I'll pull it up here. It is a Qt application, and I'm running under GNOME.
It is, but it runs really well under GNOME.
It sure does, Matt. It sure does, and it just looks great. And here, I'm going to I'll play a song here.
Okay.
Oh, didn't even know I had that unmuted. All right. So now, one of the things I want to show you is as this music is playing, in my GNOME menu here, you actually, because I have an extension turned on, I actually get the track, the album art, play controls right here, so I can play and pause. Well, should be able to play and pause.
Yep.
And there it goes. And you see it's also down here, it's integrating with my GNOME notifications. So even though, again, it's a Qt app, I can control it from GNOME, and it integrates with the GNOME.
And I think that's an important distinguisher, is that it does, even though it is, you know, a Qt app, that it is giving you that level of integration. You don't have to go fishing for extra stuff. It's going to take care of it for you when you install it.
It makes it feel like it's just integrated right in with the desktop. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm using the Media Player Indicator extension, which allows you to just control any MPRIS2 capable media player.
Right.
So like Rhythmbox, Banshee, Clementine, a lot of other ones. And then it just works right with GNOME, like it's a native GNOME app.
That's right.
So that's really cool. That makes it nice for us GNOME users.
Sure.
But Clementine itself is extremely powerful. It's got podcast management capabilities. It also has really, really good internet playback support.
Oh, it's got great,
And one of the things they've added recently is subsonic support. So if you have a subsonic server like I do, Clementine will now integrate with your subsonic server and pull down all of the music tracks that you have on your subsonic server. So here we go. I have the Batman theme. And it's on. This is streaming from my subsonic server. I don't have it on my laptop at all.
So this is remote, essentially. Remote to your LAN, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It is remote off of my my file server.
Yeah.
And it's like no delay and anything like that. It's real simple to get set up. And that's really nice because I have a ton of stuff on there. But that's not the main thing I wanted to show you guys today. The main thing I wanted to show you, which is super neat, and this is one of the new features, is it also integrates in now with a really nice Android app. Very simple and straightforward Android app, but it totally gets the job done, and I mean, that's what we want,
It's gorgeous. It's minimalist, but the buttons are easy to see, even, you know, regardless of lighting. The contrast is set well, and all the controls are just what you want.
Works on a tablet, works on a smartphone.
Mm-hmm. Nice fit. Very
and see, I'm going to close the app. So so I open up the app here on my HTC One, and it should automatically discover... So it's automatically discovered my Clementine server already. And now what's cool is it shows you the album art of my Clementine player. So you can see what you're playing, and you get basic controls. So I can pause. I can. So if I turn it up here, I'll skip the next track.
Okay.
See, and the Clementine does a nice fade. And it starts up the next track. And then down here, that was the end of the playlist. And then down here, on my GNOME desktop, I'm getting notifications of the commands that I've executed from my Android app.
Oh, that's nice.
Now, what's really neat, too, Matt, is check this out. So here I have the track that I was currently playing in Clementine, right? If I hit the menu option here, I have a download song option in the Android app, and I have a download the entire album. So I can actually download. So if I hit download song now, it's pulling down the song, and if I go check my notifications tray... I will see. There it is.
So it just goes to your download folder, I imagine.
Downloading songs, and it loads it to the SD card. And in the notification area, I can get a little Clementine icon. You see right there, it's got the little
Clementine. That's great.
Yeah, it's just doing the download.
So when it's finished downloading, then can you listen to it from Clementine?
Or no? So that's all the Clementine.
Okay.
That app is only a remote.
It's only remote.
But any app on your Android phone that can play MP3s, can then access that.
Anyway.
Yeah, you're pulling down the. And what's so cool about it is like.
And you may not want to have a lot of songs on your SD card. You may have...
Right, exactly.
That's
and it's like, okay, so I'm going to go and I'll grab this album, store them on my machine, and I'm good to go. And then when you're local on your LAN and you don't need them on your phone, you can still control it. So if this is like playing through your home stereo or something like that. I think this is I think this is like the perfect. Here, I'm going back in here. I'm starting another one now.
Yeah.
So what's cool is if I change it on Clementine, it still automatically reflects the changes on the Android app. So they're
that's cool.
They're in real time communication.
Oh, I like that. That's really neat.
And
so it's not just a remote, but it's actually you're getting some benefit because you're actually able to hear the music.
And if I go into preferences here, it's a network remote. So the way it works here is you just say you just turn on use network remote in your settings. Allow connections from the local network. You have to turn on allow downloads, and it'll show you your internal IP. So you can manually tap in the IP if you need to. But if everything's working correctly, the Android device, the Android app, should just detect your Clementine player, and then you just tap the Clementine icon, and it just automatically connects up, and then it immediately starts showing you what it's playing.
And for audio listeners, when you're looking at this, the preferences, you're literally looking at toggle boxes that you check each individual option. And then it looks like you can get the app by either using the mobile,
They got a little link here, or the QR code.
Yeah, the QR code right there.
Yep.
Bam, boom, done.
Yeah, and then you just download the Clementine player, which is free. And like you can also, like, if you have LastFM support, you can mark your LastFM songs in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can ban a song from playing from the Android player, which is nice. You can set repeat and loops and shuffle. You can change all of that from here. And here's a quick example of the Subsonic integration. So I've just signed in. Once you put in your information, it just connects to your Subsonic installation and pulls down all the tracks from that as well.
Very cool.
Yeah, it is. Clementine, it just keeps getting better and better and better. And now it's really gotten at the point where I love the UI, I love the functionality. And now with that Android app tie-in, so I can pull something out of my pocket and I can go to the next song without having to be in the same room is really nice.
Oh, definitely. And not having to use the storage on your phone is also awesome. But you know my favorite feature of that app is the fact that you have Fruit for a slider for your volume.
Yeah.
That's important to me.
And the player. That's the player indicator too, the little, little fruit piece. Yeah.
All about the fruit, man. It's like I'm going to slide my fruit.
Yeah. So, you know, I just installed this version yesterday, and I've been playing around. I was so impressed with it, I wanted to talk about it. But one of the other things I didn't quite get worked out was it sees my HTC One, but I haven't been able to get sync working yet with my HTC One. We'll see what happens with that.
Could just be needing to roll out an update.
And one other caveat is you can use the Clementine remote to remotely control your internet song. So, like, if you have a Subsonic setup or podcasts or Spotify setup in Clementine, the Clementine remote on Android can still control them, but it cannot download tracks from those services.
Okay.
So it can only download when a song is in your local media library, which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I can handle that.
Yeah, exactly. So that is Clementine combined with the Android app. And if you're a GNOME user, I also give a hearty recommendation to the Media Player Indicator. So that way you can have Clementine integrated into your GNOME system menu over here.
Very clean.
Yeah, it is. It's very clean. It works super easy and just like you'd expect. So I was pretty happy with that. Clementine, Media Player Extension, and the Clementine Remote, all which absolutely free.
Gotta love the price. Gotta love the features.
In fact, do they say, let's see. You have to have 1.2, by the way, for the remote to work.
I imagine.
So yeah, that's kind of a newer thing.
That seems reasonable, though.
Okay. I was just checking to see if there's any other gotchas, but that's it. There you have it. Oh, that's what I was looking for, too. And the Android app is GPL3.
Gosh, that's great.
Can't complain about that, can you? So that's kind of an Android app and a desktop pick all in one for you, Matt. How about
that? Good stuff.
All right, now we do have a weekly spotlight I just want to spend a moment on.
Okay.
I mentioned it on Linux Unplugged.
Yeah, we did talk about it a little bit. And that's one I need to look into more myself because I'm curious.
I wanted to give him a full plug here on the big show because now I'm not trying to take any particular stance here. There could be problems with it, but I loaded this up in a VM, and I've been using it to try out Cinnamon, too.
Sure.
And Integros is how you pronounce it, I think.
I believe Integros.
It is sort of, if you're familiar with, Manjaro.
Manjaro, yes.
So Manjaro has its own private repositories where they pull from the Arch repos.
They pull them, and then they freeze it and let it sit for a couple weeks or whatever it is. Sure.
So Integros doesn't do that. Integros is straight from the Arch repos. And the other thing they do that's kind of interesting, get ready for this, kids, is they use the Ubiquiti installer from Ubuntu.
Oh, really?
So if you know how to install Ubuntu, you can install Integros. And when you're done with that, you have a fully up-to-date Arch installation. So you have the options to do an OpenBox, KDE, GNOME, a few other options when you're installing. Mm-hmm. And once you click the install button, it pulls the latest packages from the Arch repo. So even though they haven't burned a new ISO image in since about like August, I think.
Doesn't matter because you're just going to update it anyway. It's
yeah, as you install it, pulls down the absolute latest kernel, the absolute latest GNOME packages. Everything is fresh from the Arch repo. Every update comes from the Arch repo. They do have their own private repository, but it has like minor things in there, like a couple of LibreOffice, small stuff.
Little niceties.
Yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's almost completely, totally minimal. In fact, there's tons of stuff you'll still have to install. So it basically gets you up and running with a full desktop environment of your choice using the Ubuntu installer. And then from that point forward, all future updates are delivered from the Arch repos. As far as I can tell, it is completely Arch.
That's very cool. I mean, with the exemption of those niceties that we talked about, which sound like they're very minimal, it sounds like it's just a ready-to-roll Arch-based distribution. It's ready to go.
Yeah, as Heaven's Revenge in the chat room points out, it is actual Arch with the tiniest repo and some sane defaults. Now, Blue Phoenix in the chat room has been mentioning that he's actually had some problems installing it. I just installed it Monday, I think it was.
Did he elaborate on what the problems were? Display, physically completing an installation? I'd be interesting to know where the hang-up was specifically so that we can...
But I'll tell you...
Yeah,
I'll tell
it looks
you,
really good.
Pairing that Ubiquiti installer, which I guess Manjaro kind of does too, with Integros, Arch, brilliant. I mean, to sit down and go and to sit down and within 15, 20 minutes have a fully up-to-date modern Arch installation with GNOME 3.10.1. Mm-hmm. And we're talking GNOME... You can have GNOME 3.10.1 in about 25 minutes by loading this up, and then you just... Now, obviously, you're going to cheat yourself on some of the learning experience by going through an install. But if you've been curious what we've been talking about and things like that, this is a good way to at least kick the tires and see what's up.
I think that's a great approach. I think that everybody at some point in their life should at least try an Arch installation to actually experience it. But I also think that if you just want something, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, get it up and running, this is a great option.
Yeah, I kind of go back to like if I had known how great the package repo was and stuff like that, I probably would have tried going to Arch a long time ago.
That was what
but that installation is such a barrier for some folks.
Yeah.
And this distro totally eliminates that.
And it depends, and the barrier varies on the individual. So for some people, it's a perceived time barrier. And for other people, it's an actual doability barrier.
Yeah.
It just depends on the person.
I tried to suss out how active this project is because, see, they haven't – so they've
– See, that's what put me into Manjaro's camp initially. For one thing, it was literally – initially it was an experiment because I was just curious. I was just like, oh, wow, I've heard lots of negative things about it. I'm going to try this.
Right.
That's just how I operate.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, I've really not had any problems. So I was
I reached out to them on Twitter and never heard back from them, but they haven't even updated.
Twitter since 26. They may be kind of – well, I guess it's one of those distributions, though, that if everything's pretty minimal and it's all Arch repos, you really don't care.
Yeah, and I checked their GitHub repo, and there's been activity within the last few days.
Yeah, so that's probably – it's just developers at that point.
Yeah, okay. I think this is kind of the advantage is you don't have to have a large in-house staff because you're just taking what Arch already has available and just putting it together.
No.
So it might
I
not
think
require
it sounds cool. I might check that out.
I invited them on the show, so if they're watching and like to talk to us about what they're up to – I'd be really curious because this is an early – I think it's kind of – there's some more things they're going to do with it, and I hope they stick around. It's pretty fascinating. There you go. And Integros. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well as a link to all of the other picks we've talked about. All right, Matt. Let's do the news.
Hey, it's the news, and this episode is brought to you by
Ting.com. Matt, you know that. Ting is mobile that makes sense. My mobile service provider and Matt's mobile service provider, Ting, powers our smartphones of awesomeness. And I got to tell you, Matt, now is never, ever, ever been a better time. Never, ever, ever been a better time to switch to Ting.
They got
you
covered.
So Ting, of course, you all know, no contracts, no termination fees. I think we're all savvy enough to know how awesome that is. No bundling ride-along services. We appreciate that. And, of course, include hotspot and tethering with your cell service. We all like that, too. One of the things that really makes Ting stand out, and they've been pioneering this, is the way they do their billing. You only pay for what you use. So you're not paying into a big contract that you don't end up using. You don't get the value out of. No. You always get value from Ting because you're only paying for what you need. Minutes, text messages, and megabytes are all added up at the end of the month. Whatever bucket you fall into, pow, that's what you get charged. But I did mention something, Matt. I know I've mentioned they have an awesome online control panel. I know I've mentioned you can call 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. to get a real person and take care of your problem. But did you know that Ting is now doing golden tickets?
Golden tickets?
Yeah, Matt, this is fun. And this only until the end of October, so you guys got to jump on it now. So they have 6 golden tickets available, and if you buy a phone from Ting, they come in the new Ting portfolio, and up to 3 of those will have a golden ticket slipped in there. Now, if you get a golden ticket, you get a year of Ting service for free. Now, you got some good chances here, folks, so move on this. Now, don't worry. If you're going to bring your own device over to Ting when you visit last.ting.com, they're going to also slip in a digital golden ticket for those guys,
right
too.
Right on.
So even if you're buying online,
everybody gets to play.
Everybody gets to play, nice. Matt. It is fair for everybody. This called a year of Ting service. I can't even imagine. That'd be so awesome.
That would be great.
Now, average Ting bill is $21 per month per device. That is not too bad if you think about it. And, of course, all of Ting devices are unlocked. You can go over there and get a used device, a new device. You can bring your own device.
Yeah.
They got a list of ones you can bring. And also, if you've got a gently used Moto X, I don't even know how gentle it has to be, Ting's giving up to $100 Visa gift card. Ooh. For certain qualified Moto X's. They have that over at the Ting blog. Wow. So look, here's how you get started. Goodness. You go to last.ting.com.
Okay.
That's going to take $25 off your first device, or if you bring your own device, they're going to take $25 off your first month.
So that's going to get you in the door.
Dude, for me, that made my first month free.
Right?
That was awesome. Now, I'm a paying Ting customer. I don't get a deal here. Yep. I don't get a deal. Nope. I'm paying for this full. I'm full-fledged here. I paid full price for my HTC
that's
One.
Right.
And I absolutely love it. Ting combines some of the best Android phones. Just got the 4.3 update with some of the best service that lets you do anything you need on your terms. If you need a gigabyte this month and only 500 megabytes next month, Ting's going to take care of you on there. If you only need 10 minutes 1 week, and then the next week you need 30 minutes, whatever your usage is, Ting's got you covered. In fact, I love this for small businesses because sometimes you have folks on your team who use a lot of minutes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have folks on your team who barely use their phone.
And so that's with it for me. It's I'm very heavy in data, but not so much in the voice.
Yeah.
And it allows me to do that.
I'm the same way. And I get a fantastic deal on Ting. You know, because I'm using Waze. I'm using G Plus on this all the time. I'm constantly taking pictures and uploading them via BitTorrent Sync. So the data is a big part. And what's great about Ting is a lot of areas now are getting lit up with LTE service. And that is awesome. LTE is like magic in your phone. So go to last.ting.com. That'll get you started. Also, I encourage you to click on that "How much would you save?" button. If you're kind of on the fence, this is something you got to look at. Yeah, And then also, I want you to take in consideration that Ting has an early termination relief program. Now, this is going to help you get out of that contract, so you can start saving even sooner. They'll give you up to $75 per device. All you have to do, you'll go pick out your Ting device, you port your number, and then you submit your ETF claim, and they'll take $75 off that ETF if it qualifies.
And they make the whole process easy. I mean, it's
super easy.
It's not like it sounds like, oh my gosh, I got to do what now? No, you just go through the motions. They'll take care of you.
Mm-hmm. And their website's very, very straightforward.
That's right.
They've got online user forms if you don't want to have to call somebody. But if you do, like we mentioned earlier, they legitimately have Canadians standing by to take your call when you call 1-855-TING-FTW. Not only does a real person answer the phone, but that person owns your problem. And they will see it through the beginning to the end and make sure it gets resolution. They'll even give you their direct number in some cases.
See,
if they
that's a big piece, because how many times have you called for support or something and then you're handed off to that next person?
Oh, yeah.
This doesn't happen with Ting.
No. Their support folks are empowered to solve your
that's
problem.
Right.
It's pretty awesome. So go to last.ting.com. And thanks to Ting for sponsoring the Linux Action Show.
Woohoo!
Love Ting.
Love these guys.
Loving my phone still, man.
You're right, yeah.
Loving it. All right, so this week's news docket is packed with a few stories that I honestly hoped we weren't going to have to cover.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about Ubuntu in the last few weeks because the 13.10 review is here, so that was the time.
It was kind of an event.
Yeah.
You know?
And honestly, the goal of this week's episode was really not to avoid the topic of Ubuntu, but just really not to focus on it anymore because
to focus on other cool things that we're equally excited about.
Yeah, we've set our bet, and there's things we like and so forth. However, if you didn't check the interwebs over the weekend, there's a bit of a kerfuffle that was kicked up. It started on Friday when Mark Shuttleworth took to his blog to not only sort of celebrate the release of 1310, but to also announce the name for 1404.
Starts off nice enough.
Yeah, it really does start out quite good. He talks about how 1310 is officially out the door, and it's a wonderful achievement.
Yeah.
A real, you know, go team kind of.
Absolutely.
Exactly what
no
you
problems
expect.
There.
Later on in the article, this is where, and unfortunately it's gotten the majority of the attention, this is kind of where things went off the rails. Mark writes, Canonical has its fair share of competitors and detractors who love to undermine the work it does, but I think that wiser heads appreciate the magnitude of the effort required to break this ice. He's talking about going to mobile. And the extent to which it's taken courage and grace under fire for this team to deliver such a sharp 1.0 of the mobile experience for Ubuntu. So I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, Canonical has its fair share of detractors.
Sure.
But that is,
you
I
know,
think, a legitimate.
It was legitimate. He's kind of, you can see where he was going as you keep reading. But yeah. It's edging out there.
Yeah. I think, you know, there are people out there who like to bang on it just because it's from Canonical. He talks a little more. He goes on to talk about Mir. He says Mir is really important work. With lots of when lots of competitors attack a project on purely political grounds, you have to wonder what their agenda is. At least we know who belongs to the open source Tea Party.
Oh, see, that was a, yeah, I understand his concern, frustration, what have you, but I also know that once you put words out there, they're really hard to retract, and I think he's experiencing that now.
Well, and it,
and I think that was poor choice.
The analogy between folks in the open source community who think Mir is a bad decision and the Tea Party is kind of a weak analogy to begin with.
Well, and perhaps from an outsider's point of view, for someone that doesn't live in the States, that maybe that's how he interpreted it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it definitely is it's a very hot topic with people that probably would have done better to – because what's happened is everybody's now focusing on that terminology versus the context of the article.
And, you know, it was – Mark was taking – so I believe – now, this is my interpretation, but when Mark says that – so, sure. I you know, the worldview, just based on what I hear from a lot of – unfiltered emailers who live
outside
the world.
Which is great to get the, you know, get that third party.
The Tea Party is seen as an obstructionist group who will go to no ends to see their agenda and who are radical and block rational discourse. Now,
this is the offshore interpretation.
Right. I'm not prescribing that.
I'm agnostic,
on them,
honestly. So,
but that is sort of the offshore of view. So, I believe he is taking those sort of stereotypes,
right?
And potentially, you know, that's what he's kind of what he's using there.
Sure.
But he goes on to say. And this is kind of why he doesn't understand why Mir has gotten so much heat. He says, Mir is relevant for approximately 1% of all developers, just those who think about shell development. Mm-hmm. Every app developer will consume Mir through their toolkit.
Okay.
Now, I think technically that's not a correct statement. But
wishful thinking, maybe? I don't know.
Maybe on the very, very large, broad picture, it's correct. But,
sure.
I mean, in reality, I think anybody who's made an application on the Linux desktop at some point has to deal with X issues.
And again,
like
this is his interpretation. Your mileage may vary.
Mir is relevant for, he goes on to say, so it's relevant for 1%. Those are just the developers. By contrast, those same outraged individuals have not invented here just about every important piece of the stack they can get their hands on, most notably systemd, which is hugely invasive and hardly justified. What closely to see how competitors to Canonical torture the. That's what
he made a typo. So you can tell it's very probable that he got a little flustered about this point.
What closely to see how competitors to Canonical torture the English language in their efforts to justify how those toolkits should support Windows but not Mir. So he's kind of talking about like Kwin and things in KDE at Qt where they're going to a lot of efforts to make sure that Windows support is there, but not necessarily Mir. And he goes on to say that I think when he says when they torture the English language, they're going through lengthy blog posts to talk about justification.
And his point on systemd, I mean, again, this is his interpretation of it. I've used systemd. I'm quite content with it, honestly. I've actually had less problems with it than I have with the alternative. So, you know, and again, I'm agnostic on this whole thing, but I disagree with him on that.
So I think to appreciate the systemd comment, first of all, I think this is just me being nitpicky. I think it's interesting that he typoed the systemd has no uppercases and it's not intercased.
Right.
It is all lowercase. And the only reason I mention that is because if you're familiar with systemd, you know that's kind of a big deal about systemd, that they've covered this a lot. In fact, there's even a free desktop.org page dedicated to how you're supposed to type systemd. And so by getting it wrong, it might imply a little unfamiliarity with the project. So just keep that in mind. You know, I look at it this. So this, he goes on to say, you know, there's politics, there's an agenda, and he brings up Mir, he brings up systemd. The politics and agenda he'd be talking about is Canonical versus Red Hat. And if you think about where Canonical actually makes their money, Canonical makes their money on the cloud. The cloud would be the number one spot they're competing with Red Hat.
Right. So now it's become very hyper-competitive amongst two competitors, and I get that. So there's going to be some emotion there. There's going to be some tension, sure. That's fair.
Yeah, and so it doesn't. Yeah. So the reason why that's a little bit, I think, of a faulty assumption to make is Upstart was chosen by Red Hat for Red Hat Enterprise Linux. The team there deployed it.
Right.
They shipped, you know, a multi-year supported distribution using Upstart, and they looked at it from that perspective. Lennart Pottering and the other people on his team looked at it from that perspective.
From
and
a
said,
deployed perspective, right?
We have this deployed to potentially millions of servers running in data centers, and we feel that Upstart isn't solving the problems that we have. It was a good first try, but the thing is Upstart's kind of reached a point and really hasn't moved forward a lot, and it still is sort of has ties to the legacy way of doing things.
So perhaps Red Hat saying, it's not good enough. We have these concerns that aren't being addressed. Mark is saying perhaps that it is good enough. I fail to see the problem.
Right.
And but what's going, you know.
The other thing you have to, but see, okay, the reason why that also doesn't work is because the market has chosen systemd.
That is
right?
True.
Arch,
by and large.
OpenSUSE, yeah. Fedora.
That's right.
Debian. They're
and that
all,
may be a sore spot for Mark.
They're all, but I think you when you have the entire market deciding on a technology like that, it might be an indicator that there's some technological reasons for that, not just political reasons, because you have other competing entities like Novell, SUSE, or not Novell anymore, but AutoCAD. Right. I'm forgetting their names. But they're essentially competitors with Red Hat, and they're choosing system.
Right.
So I think it's more than just a political thing.
Well, and I don't – I mean, there's definitely politics in Linux. I'm not going to pretend like there's not. But I think in this particular case, a lot of it is very likely practical in the fact that they can point to a deployed situation to where they weren't happy with it. They're not just talking about it. They actually tried it. It wasn't for them. They want to try, they want to use systemd because for practical reasons. That seems to be my interpretation of the situation as someone that's, you know, trying very hard not to get,
you know,
get into the sides of
and
it.
And I don't mean to pick because there's also a lot of good stuff. He says, I'm very proud to be, as the register puts it, the Ubuntu daddy. My affection for this community is in the broadest sense, from Mint to our cloud developer audience and the teams at Canonical and each of our derivatives. It's very tangible today. He says, as such, our focus is going to be on performance, refinement, manageability, technical debt. It would be entirely appropriate for us to make conservative choices for the upcoming VUDSs, the Virtual Developer Summits. So please join us for the discussion as we shape 1404. He announces they're going to name it Trusty Tar.
Tar? See, and the rest of the
post...
Yeah,
it's real good, right?
Yeah,
the rest of the post is real good. Yeah.
I think that he hit on a sore subject that... This is
calling out systemd and calling out Mir and calling people who are against it the open source Tea Party.
Here's the thing, and
it's
this
like,
is how it works with companies I do.
It's
even
like throwing gas on the fire.
Even you know, regardless of where you're at in the company, generally speaking, when you put something out, you have someone vet your post before it goes out. Not because of editing mistakes or anything like that, but sometimes a tone can be misinterpreted or it just comes out really douchey, depending on which way you want to go with it. You know, get someone to vet the stuff before it goes out there, because even if you didn't mean it the way it sounds, it does sound really abrupt.
You know,
douchey, honestly.
Like KP in the chat room says, this is really kind of like a bad news sandwich, because it's bad news sandwich between good news here. I think
he nailed it.
I think if we the call outs to Mir and systemd and the open source Tea Party.
Yeah.
Generated a massive response online.
Oh yeah, just a little. Yeah, and it really, and this is the blowback, and this is why I say, I you know, you got to vet the stuff before you put it out there,
right.
Guys.
Or just go with the original post that Jono made, which was great.
Yeah, that's my point. Well, that's what I'm saying. He and I know Jono agrees with me. He's gonna want it. He wants to vet this. I know he does. I know he wants to vet this before it goes out the door,
because he knows how it's going to go over.
Well, it's his butt that gets chewed.
So
honestly.
Aaron, pretty quickly, Aaron Saigo took to G+, and he called out. Specifically, where Mark said Mir is really important work with lots of competitors attack the project on purely political grounds, you have to wonder what their agenda is. So Aaron
and
kind
of
took offense.
I can understand him being upset by that. I mean, I get Aaron's point of view on that. I do.
And what Aaron essentially called for was, he said, let's do an online live debate. Let's go on the Linux Action Show and let's discuss the merits of Mir and Wayland and the implications of free software. Now,
if we did it presidential debate style, it might work, maybe.
Yeah.
But
we'd
have to have certain guidelines in place to where everybody's just, you know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think one thing people have to keep in mind is both Aaron and Mark are classy guys. I think if they were on – so this is
– we could see them having beers together in another situation.
This is why I said yes to this proposal, because I feel like if you had two people sitting down and talking instead of talking through their blogs, there would be a much more real with less rhetoric type conversation. There would be a – I think this. Well, I think this.
Exactly.
And there wouldn't be people taking blog posts, interpreting them, writing their own blog posts with thousands of comments on those posts, getting to Slashdot and getting to Reddit.
That's
right. You know, I mean,
well, and tone is easily misinterpreted in text. That's why I'm always doing smiley faces. It's not because I'm a giggling idiot. It's honestly because of the fact that I need people to understand that I'm not upset with you. But here's my point. And that's hard to do in text.
I think the fundamental problem here is the open source community is looking at Mir and other things and saying, you know, I mean, hell, this goes back to Launchpad even. They're looking at this stuff and saying, this causes unnecessary fragmentation.
Okay.
And the core argument they have is, at a time when a lot of us are working together, you're introducing fragmentation. And if you remember, some of the original arguments against why they had to create Mir and go against Wayland were based on kind of, you know, things they had to retract off their wiki, right? So it kind of set the tone. And I kind of feel like while a lot of people are harshing on Saigo and other folks saying, you know, Mark has even said, and Jono said, is, hey, we just want to create code, man. Get off our back so we can just create code. I don't understand why you're harshing on our buzz here.
Right.
We're just trying to make code, dude, and this is open source, and it's going to be open code, man. Can't we all just get along, dude? But the reality is the tone keeps getting pushed into the more and more aggressive channels by Canonical. Not by Lennart, not by Aaron Saigo, but when they launch things, the way those launches have been handled set the tone of the conversation. When they launched Mir on the grounds that Wayland wasn't capable enough and that Wayland was deficient, and they said it was deficient in ways that it was not actually deficient, they then set the stage for future conversations around that. And then, as we remember, this has happened the last time Mark made a big blog post, something gets said that upsets people and then sets the tone another level to a little more hostile. And I think, again, when Mark came out and said the Tea Party thing, I think that set the tone of the conversation a bit more aggressively.
It did. No, there's no question of that. So here's the thing. Like when they, you know, when they're saying Wayland wasn't meeting their needs, that's probably a better way of saying it in the way that it was said. Using choice words and then leaving it alone, just saying, look, it didn't meet our needs. And
do you see some hypocriticalness here when Mark comes out and says, well, look, systemd and all these things are a product of the not invented here syndrome. And the guy that's saying that is the guy behind.
Oh, Mark's not helping the situation.
Launchpad,
there's no question about none.
Unity,
none, yeah, no, there's
Mir.
No question that he is definitely. I don't want to say he's Steve Ballmering the situation, but
I'd say he's more Steve Jobsing in a way.
Steve Jobs could get away with it.
It's a little revisionist in a sense.
As messed up as it is, Steve Jobs got away with it. No, I think that he thinks that he can. You know, I mean, it's his opinion, and he wants to express it, and that's fine. But you got to understand, for every action, there's an equal and sometimes even greater reaction.
Oh, I think Mark knows that, though.
But I think he's in denial about it. I think that he can't fathom how people aren't getting it from his perspective.
Right. I completely agree.
And so, you know, and I'm concerned about that.
All of this just sort of built. So that started on Friday, built over the whole weekend. Last night, Sunday at 4 a.m., Mark Shuttleworth posts to G+.
Yeah.
And his response, surprisingly, wasn't actually directed at Aaron, who has actually been sort of leading the response to this. Yeah. Instead, it's pointed at Lennart Pottering.
Right.
Mark's opening line, Lennart completely misses the point. Now, I've checked Lennart's social posts and his blog posts and his Twitter. He really didn't much
have to say. Well, it would
help
if he actually provided a link for context. So I can, yeah.
He says, so he goes on to say, what is hypercritical is the tendency, this is Mark, and the many and many colleagues who rant about Canonical is to project someone else's right to do the same. Constant partisan critiques of code purely for existing is bizarrely political approach. See, this goes, Mark's not getting it. See, he thinks people are upset that they're creating code.
Yeah.
But that's not what people are upset
about.
That's
what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, where Mark's not understanding what the concern is. He's living very much in a singular vision, and that's kind of the guy he is.
We are on a mission.
We're on a mission.
And these people are detracting from our mission.
And you're either on board, you're either on the ship with us, or you're a stowaway. I mean, you're in the way and you're bugging us, and we need you to just get out of the road.
He furthers your point by saying, I think it's telling that the harshest criticisms of Upstart and Mir has nothing to do with code, but rather the company it comes from.
And that, again,
there is a degree of that.
It's his interpretation. I think that there is definitely those that feel that way, but I don't think that by and large that's all of it. I think it's much greater than that for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I agree. And then Mark says, ask yourself, do you want more innovation? Why would you trash someone's efforts to prove any aspect of the free software stack?
Because, I mean, at that point, he could go after Stallman or anyone else that, you know, is even going further down the line as far as their concerns. At the end of the day, say your piece and just focus on what you need to focus on. That's my philosophy.
I kind of feel like
feeding it back.
And that's what Jono – see, this is what's interesting. This is kind of what Mark's take is now, and that's what Jono's initial response was. Well, guys, let's just focus on the code.
Right.
But the problem is – it's kind of like they came in and smacked the hornet's nest and then complained that the hornet stung.
Right.
Isn't it? I mean, because
but you have different mindsets within the company. You have one mindset, which is Mark's mindset of he did in fact smack the hornet's nest. And then the other employees of the company are then left to pick up those pieces. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel bad for those that are affected, because that's kind of that's the situation they're put in. It's like, okay, now they have to come in and say, no, actually, for us personally, this is how we see it. And everybody thinks that thinks Canonical's like this hive brain, and it's not.
There are
individual people with individual opinions.
I think when you read this, and you keep in mind, I truly believe that Mark thinks that Red Hat is the bad guy. Red Hat is their number one competition. And I think he sees a lot of those actions through that lens. And maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe behind the scenes, there's a lot of political things going on that we don't appreciate.
I'm sure there are. But I at the end of the day, it's being right is a very lonely way to live. I said this earlier earlier in the show. And I think it's important to remember that you can be right all day long, but it doesn't mean the those around you are going to agree with you. It just doesn't. It doesn't matter. What matters is accepting everybody's got their opinion. Can we cooperate at some level? Mm-hmm. If not, can we at least be cordial to one another?
And I think the key here is the community. And when I say community, I mean like Aaron, Mark. Aaron, Lennart, Martin, some other folks who've been chiming in. They're talking about the technical aspects of it. They're talking about the community aspects of it. They're talking about the long-term impacts of it.
Absolutely.
And Mark is talking about vision, about pushing forward the mobile platform, about creating a unified experience that they have full control over.
Sure.
And the thing is they're not even debating the same things. They're not even thinking about the same things.
Talking at each other at this point.
Right. They're talking completely at each other. And so there's really no progress being made on either side. And I think maybe that's why an actual in-person debate would actually potentially help. But I go back to this. At the end of the day, none of this needed to happen.
No.
What did it accomplish?
That's my philosophy.
I have it highlighted in the show notes. If you go look in the show notes to Mark's blog post, if you just remove the spots that I have highlighted, it's a great blog post.
Yeah.
And it doesn't cause any of this drama. And it allows people to just go back and focus on what they're doing. I mean, I think we'd all like to just see the market prove which approach
that
is
would
better.
Be the logical approach.
Yeah.
That would be that, and unfortunately, we're not. But people aren't robots, and they make choices that sometimes bite them in the butt. And I think it's what we're seeing here.
So I guess the flip side is I think it's pretty clear that Mark has genuine, true passion about what they're.
Oh yeah, crazy passionate about what he's doing. As you know, as is
crazy,
the
crazy passionate might actually be the right way to describe it.
Sure.
And what I mean by that is, I think we could probably agree. And this just happens when you're really, really involved with something.
Yeah.
There's some perspective lost. There's a little bit of perspective that's been lost, and so when you match that with the fact that they're not really having the same conversation, you get nowhere.
That's right.
And then what you get is the BSD guys and the commercial software guys sitting back and laughing at the open source community.
They're thinking, this is why we don't, you know, and then, of course, then they'll stereotype their own thing, and they will. And believe me, I know they are already. So.
And I think part of this, too, is a little bit of sore butt over the response to 1310. It wasn't just our review that was like, good but meh. Every review was good but meh.
Yeah.
Every review was, it's good release, but it's meh. And I think that still hurts a little. I think what we're seeing here is the Ubuntu desktop is still important to these guys.
Sure.
And when people criticize it a little bit, they start to get a little hurt. And when you start criticizing something that impacts also their new vision, then they really respond.
Well, and I also think that you're participating in a space to where rolling releases are becoming increasingly popular. And so the idea of a release party or an event of a new release has become is really less important than it was 2-3 years ago. Who cares? I mean, that's kind of, I'm not saying that legitimately. I mean, that's how a lot of people perceive it of is that it's like, yeah, but I'm running this other distro over here and I've already had those features for 3 months now.
And I also wonder if the Smart Scopes thing hasn't been pushed, very hardly by Mark himself. I wonder if Mark's been sort of the chief advocate of the Smart Scopes. And like the chat room is saying, every single review out there said, Ubuntu's great, just turn off the Smart Scopes.
Right.
I mean, that is universally bad.
Personally, based on my understanding of how this stuff comes about, I suspect it was introduced as a marketing idea by someone else in the company, and it was probably and Mark saw it as, oh, this is great. It fell into his vision scope, no pun intended, and he shot forward with it to where once it's in Mark's vision,
it's part of the narrative.
Yeah, part of his narrative. Yeah, exactly. And so he took it and ran with it, and now it's part of his personality. It's part of who he is. It's part
of the vision for the desktop.
His vision, the whole thing. Yeah. That's tough.
We'll move on. We'll move on. We've covered it, and neither one of us want to take too hard of a stance because I think both parties have some justifiable grievances here. However, I really wish Mark would use his position as a figurehead in the community to change the direction of these conversations and not make them worse. And I realize that's asking a lot when you feel like you're under attack. And it's almost inconceivable because I realize at the end of the day, you're a person too. And, this stuff feels like they're attacking you. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like when the president says something, it has huge ramifications. Like, there's a red line right here. And then everybody talks about a red line.
And here's why this is a big issue. With a president is a great example. Generally, the cabinet members are yes men. And that's essentially what we're dealing with here is you're dealing with – you have a lot of people that are also equally passionate about the same stuff that Mark is passionate about. You need to integrate some people in there that think you're full of beans because when that happens, it makes you think critically, and that needs to happen. You need to add maybe one or two people in there that maybe don't agree with you and that are really adamantly disagreeing with you and say, no, actually, I think the direction we're going is wrong and here's why. Doesn't mean you're going to agree with them, Mark, but it's just something to consider.
You remember, I go back and remember I said a few weeks ago, I think some developers have drunk in the Steve Jobs Kool-Aid and they think that they figured out how Steve Jobs did it, so that's what they do.
Yeah.
And one of the things about Steve Jobs that people don't really appreciate in retrospect is he changed his mind all the time. He'd say, you know, we're never going to ship an iPod that plays video, right? If you read his biography...
But he was subtle about it. He wasn't blogging about it.
Right. And if you read his biography, he was vehemently against iTunes for Windows. He said, we will never ship iTunes for Windows. We will never make iTunes for Windows. And then they made iTunes for Windows, and guess what? It, like, way outsold their Mac versions. Yeah. And I think when people...
And he also had people worked for him that did not agree with him.
Right. And I think Mark needs that more than ever right now. And I also... You know what? Let's move on from Upstart SystemD. SystemD is great. People are using it. Upstart is great. It does what it needs to do. People are using it. Upstart came along before SystemD. That's not invented here thing by Canonical's point of view. They needed a problem. They solved it. Red Hat saw a problem they needed to solve. They tried Upstart.
The casual end user, and let's be honest about this, because I really don't know. For myself as an end user that sometimes uses Ubuntu, sometimes uses other distributions, outside of having to remember whether I'm using a SystemD setup or not, Is there a reason, honestly,
users
for me to care?
No.
I don't see it yet.
At the end of the day,
we will someday, but not at this point.
It looks like another open source freak show at the end of the day.
I don't care. Yeah. I mean, so that's my big concern is that, you know, you're both right, you're both wrong, let's move on.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, I don't know.
And let's make code.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And, you know, although I just wanted to say, I admire Aaron for being willing to sort of be the front of some of this because he is being attacked as people are just saying, oh, you just hate Ubuntu. Oh, you hate Canonical. You hate.
No,
all
I don't think that's true at all. I don't think that's his issue. I do agree that his heart's in the right place. Mm-hmm. I think everything that needs to be said has been said. And it's like, you know, whatever. Let's just move on.
So let's talk about some new code that we all can get our hands on here pretty soon. And that is VirtualBox 4.3. A couple of interesting things in this release. First of all, if you want to play around with Windows 8.1, they got support for that now, including if you have like a multi-touch interface device, VirtualBox now supports multi-touch in the guest. Kind of neat.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. They have also much improved 3D acceleration for guests such as Fedora and other distros. They say they've significantly revamped the internals of VirtualBox as a platform for future performance enhancements. Today, right now, that means improved boot time for guests, but they're renovating the hypervisor all over, which is kind of exciting. Lots, nice IPv6 support built in.
Wow.
They have a new feature that I'll show you here in just a sec. 4.3 comes with built-in video capture, records the contents of your guest screens to a WebM file.
Whoa!
Really neat. Yeah.
That could be very handy.
And now also VirtualBox supports the virtual webcam device that allows the pass-through of your webcam into VirtualBox.
Like when I need to Skype with more than one person.
And
that would be nice.
You know, when you're just trying out different apps, it's like...
Yeah.
It's just nice. Like you want to do a hangout in VirtualBox or something.
Exactly.
Or
you want to test cheese out on another distro.
Yep. Sure. So I will show you just real quickly. Here is the VirtualBox 4.3. I have it loaded on my Urchbox.
Urch.
And when you go into the settings of a virtual machine and you look over here at the display tab, you'll see over here there's now a video capture tab. And you can turn that on and you just say where you want to save the video to. And you say what you want. I want 1080. Boom, right there, right? 25 frames per second.
And do you have to have your video memory 30? Set to anything special for that? Or
it uses the host video memory.
Also, it doesn't care.
Yeah.
Okay.
So as long as you have enough.
Sure.
And then, you know, the bit rate and which screen, if it's got multiple screens of the VM. And then you hit OK. And then when the virtual machine starts up, it writes everything that happens in that virtual machine to a WebM file. Now, this to me seems like this could be super great for like a tutorial on an install.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Tutorials, this could be huge for. And a lot of projects would be like, here's how you do this. And then you can just fire up a VirtualBox VM, record it, and then you could just take that WebM file, dump it on the web or throw it into a video editor and tweak it a little bit. That's a pretty neat feature, I think.
I think it's an excellent feature.
They're working on a lot of improvements for the guests, and I'm curious to see where they go with the performance. Because I think right now, in my personal experience, VMware Workstation still has the lead for performance,
still pulling a little bit ahead.
But if they're tweaking that hypervisor, that could introduce some issues. But it's kind of neat. And one last little link I wanted to give you guys, just something to check out on your own after the show. Have you heard about redecentralized.org?
No, I have not.
Well, it's kind of a lot of what we've been talking about. Over the last few years, we've noticed, this is on their site, quite a few people trying to spread the internet out again, back to the edges. You know, a series of individual networks interconnected, right? Sometimes they do it for privacy. Sometimes they do it for resilience against disaster. Sometimes they do it to bring playfulness back to computers and how we use them. So redecentralized.org is about decentralizing the internet again,
sure.
Going back to a decentralized
a little more
internet.
Old school. Yeah.
And they have over on their site, which we have linked, they have some interviews that they've conducted already, seven of them, each with different folks who are working on projects that help decentralize the internet.
That's
like here's somebody here working on ArcOS. Mm-hmm. ArcOS makes it easy to securely self-host your websites, emails, and et cetera. Cryptosphere.
Wow.
Cryptosphere, an open source P2P web application platform, right?
Nice.
Zero tier creates a flat virtual Ethernet network of almost unlimited size.
These are very powerful ideas.
Yeah, so you can go watch these. These are guys that are sort of leading the forefront of re-decentralizing. I think it's a good term,
too. That's really cool.
That's at redecentralized.org. And you'll notice when you watch some of those interviews that Linux is at the heart a lot of
those efforts.
Yeah.
I imagine so. It looks like they have a subscribe feature and everything.
Yeah, it is truly, Linux is truly the decentralized OS, so it makes sense for a decentralized web. Just saying, Matt.
Just saying.
All right, very good. That's all the news. Oh, wait, actually, we have one more story.
One more.
Before we run, I just wanted to, I don't have a lot to say on this one.
Sure.
But I thought it was interesting. Is TrueCryptAuditedYet.com?
Oh, boy. That's an attention getter.
Yeah, and right now the answer is no. However, this is a fundraising project that's seen a lot. They've got an Indiegogo. They're up on a Bitcoin funding website. They're taking funds from their – it's actually seen quite a bit of traction. And what they're trying to do is a license to review the license of the later versions of TrueCrypt to make sure that they're FOSS compatible so that way they can be bundled with distros.
Sure, sure.
They're also trying to adopt a deterministic build process for Tor that the Tor is using now for
this is a good idea.
Yeah, for TrueCrypt, so that way they can make sure that the binaries are safe and untampered. They say it's a precondition to everything, so they really need to get that right.
Yeah.
And they also want to pay out bug bounties. Not every developer has time
that's
to dot it.
Need more of that, yes.
So give out some bounties if people find stuff. So they're raising a ton of money right now. As of October 17th, in just one avenue, they've raised $36,000. Let's go check their Indiegogo page.
You know, you could really sum up their Indiegogo page with no money, no honey. You know,
and 28,000 on this.
Wow! And yeah. I think they're going to reach it. 55 days left. They've already raised 25 of 28.
People are really. I think you know
they're serious about it.
Let's take advantage of the fact that TrueCrypt is open source software. Let's make sure it's safe and with all the latest NSA revelations. I think this is awesome, and I believe this demonstrates to all of us why core security infrastructure code like this, like TrueCrypt, needs to be open source.
Agreed.
We need to be able to have this kind of option in. We need to, when something the scope that has happened with the Snowden leaks in 2013,
isn't it
sort of a peace of mind to know that a lot of people have gone through the TrueCrypt code and audited it and made sure it's safe? So if you want to check out.
If it's not, I guarantee you that's going to be a thing.
Yeah. And so you can check on the status. They have it right up there, is TrueCryptAuditedYet.com, and they have a description of the project, how you can contribute to help. They're going to, if they raise enough money, they're going to hire professional crypto analysis people who professionally audit cryptology code, and they're going to go in there and analyze it and get a complete certification of non-tamperedness.
That would be great.
And and then also, if all works out, we'll be able to get the newer versions of TrueCrypt bundled into Linux distributions.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Nice.
All right, Matt, that is all the news for this week. It's time to talk about a surprisingly powerful Linux-powered NAS that runs silently in your home. I'm really excited to talk about this, but first, I want to thank our segment sponsor, System 76,
woo-hoo!
Creators of machines born to run Ubuntu. And you know, as Ubuntu 13.10 has rolled out, System 76 has been right there to make sure all of their customers need the information to upgrade. They've had instructions on their website, which laptops might have issues, if any. Turns out, none.
Yeah,
and also, they include, like, here's the repo if you want to get the latest System 76 stable driver. Just add this after you upgrade. Like, really nice, easy, straightforward stuff.
Helps stuff like Hibernate and Suspend and whatnot.
Yep. Yeah. And I ran 13.10 on my Bonobo during our review. Flawless.
Right? I mean, it's like,
whoa. Absolutely, completely, and totally flawless. And they just rolled out a new machine. Check this out. It's the Darter Ultra Thin 14.1-inch touchscreen.
Oh, and by the way, plus 5 hours on battery life, I checked.
Yeah, isn't that great?
The first thing I went to.
Yep,
there it is.
So,
okay.
You know, I have had a little bit of envy with the Windows 8 guys who I'm not saying I would full-time interact with my PC on the touchscreen. But every now and then, there is something that's nice about, flip that up or touch that just really quick.
Sure.
And as more and more things go touch, There's going to be folks out there that want to run Linux on their desktop but try out their touch applications. And this is going to be the perfect machine to do that. You can stay in a well-supported Linux environment. You can build those touch applications. And it looks super nice, really well-done trim. Look at that nice brushed metal.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
And nice and thin, 14.1-inch screen. HDMI out, yeah, Ethernet built in, which is not all of the laptops of this size have Ethernet.
That's a big point right there.
Yeah, and right now they have a special deal on $5 ground shipping if you order like before the 28th, I think. That battery life is incredible. You know, part of that is because of Haswell, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, totally.
System 76. They've got great laptops.
Now look at how fluid the touchpad is with the rest of the computer. It's just flawless.
Yeah, that is looking really slick. And also, you know, if maybe you're not the laptop person, you just want to have a fantastic Linux desktop. I mean, super, super great Linux desktop. Check out they got a whole line from really practical, straightforward workhorse machines to total premium performance packages that are designed to be professional grade. I love the lineup. This is System 76's best lineup they've had in years.
It is. My wife's got an eye for the one standalone.
The Sable Complete?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She loves
it. I know. That Sable Complete is
She's perfect. Like, I'd use that.
I think Sable Complete would be really great in office spaces, too.
Yes. Very aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah. And, of course, they've got great, great support to back it up, too, so you're never left out in the cold. Go over to System76.com. Get yourself something great and tell them the Linux Action Show sent you. You know, if you want to jump around with different distros, you want to try different things, there is such a peace of mind knowing that the hardware in your laptop is supported.
Right.
You know, when I try out Arch or OpenSUSE or Fedora or Ubuntu, I love the fact that I never have to worry, is it going to work on my laptop?
Or is my Wi-Fi going to work? That's a big one. That's especially with laptops. Yeah, that's the, you know, am I going to do the Broadcom dance or not?
If you're still struggling with Wi-Fi, you're doing it wrong.
That's
Go over to System 76 and just get it taken care
of. That's right.
So I got sent the Synology DS412 Plus for review. I've made public some of my storage issues the air. And right now, this is essentially going up against a free NAS appliance that I have from IX Systems, which I really like a lot. And you guys know
you're able to kind of compare these.
Yeah. I'm a pretty big ZFS fan, too. Mm-hmm. So I'll be honest, was wearing a little bit of my skeptical pants when this arrived on my door because I thought, you know, I want a man's NAS. You can't put enough horsepower and performance for what I need in an appliance box like this.
That's a big, tall order.
Right?
It really is.
So the Synology Disk Station, this one that came configured with four terabyte drives, Western Digital Reds, which is how I roll these
days. That's how you want,
And if you're watching the video version, I'm showing you some product pictures of it, and you don't get a good sense of how big it is. It's smaller than you'd think. So I took some video of it before the show, and kind of give you a visual overview of what it looks like. Now, inside this machine is a Linux kernel 3.2.4.0. It's got 1 gigabyte of DDR3 RAM, and it has a quad core, I believe. It looks like it based on proc info. Intel Atom D2701 running at 2.1 gigahertz.
Okay, so low power consumption, but you got decent cooling.
Yeah,
got hot swappable drives.
Your theoretical max, if you do link aggregation, because it has 2 gigabit Ethernet ports, is 205 megabytes a second reading, 182 megabytes a second writing. With one Ethernet port, I'm getting about 95 megabytes a second, which is still great. On the back, it has USB 3. It has eSATA, like I mentioned, two LAN ports for aggregating if you want, or you can just use one. It's got passive CPU cooling. It's got the Atom processor in there. It has support for Active Directory and Windows ACLs if you have Windows clients. It has iSCSI support, so you can do virtualized servers on it. And it also has 44 watts. Let me play it again so you can eyeball it. It only uses 44 watts of power in standard operation, right? So compare that to my current unit, which is using quite a bit more. It's a full-fledged PC. And of course,
immediately you see a power consumption difference there as far as what's being used. That's kind of nice.
If you pause it here, so if you see here, it's got two Ethernet ports. There's the power port, and then my finger's right now covering up the eSATA port.
Well, and I like how everything's centralized to one side versus being spread out through the entire back, which is kind of nice when you're trying to do cord management.
And you see those big fans?
Oh, yes.
First of all, they run at minimal speeds, so that way they move enough air, and there's temperature sensors in the unit that gives you a readout of your temperature status. If one of those fans fails, the other fan can detect that and then pick up to make up for the lost cooling.
Oh, nice. It's like RAID for your fans, right?
And they are user serviceable. You just pop them off from the back. You can contact Synology, and they'll send you a new one, which is pretty nice. So as far as networking protocols, it supports SIFS, AFP, FTP, iSCSI, Telnet, SSH, NFS, NMP, WebDAV, and, of course, CalDAV. Why not, right? And the file system on the hard drives is EXT4. It supports external EXT3 FAT and TFS drives. So it's using EXT4 on the actual drives. That was very appealing to me because I like the idea that in an emergency, I could pop one of those out and any Linux box could
Yeah, right. Just bam, done.
So it also uses something called Synology Hybrid RAID, which allows you, in the right conditions, to add drives of different sizes and expand an existing array. Sort of like that Drobo-like functionality where you can say, all right, well, I want to start out with 2 4-terabyte drives. Mm-hmm. I'll leave 2 slots open, and then I'm going to add more drives. It supports maximum 4 terabytes each. And then, of course, it has eSATA and USB 3, so you could do external storage. So that's the basics of the machine there. But I knew all that when they sent it to me.
Sure.
Because I've followed Synology a little bit because I've considered them for some of my clients before. What I had not seen until I'd actually gotten my hands on a Synology box is actually how you administer a Synology server.
So, which is gorgeous. I mean, it's just a really good looking
desktop.
Yeah,
here it is right here. This is the is the Synology admin UI. And let me frame it for the camera. It is surprisingly easy to use. You could throw this in the hand of pretty much any Windows user because it has a very standard desktop-like interface paradigm. It's got a start menu-like thing where a lot of your control is done at. So let me walk you through this a little bit. So you have a lot of options here. First of all, the storage manager. Let's go into the deets first.
Okay.
This is where you set up your drives. You can see here I have one volume. You see my 4 drives running. The 3.64 is the usable.
Sure.
Combined together, that gives them a 10 terabyte capacity. It's using a Synology Hybrid RAID, so I can withstand one drive failure, but I can also add additional drives to this existing established volume.
Oh, so you can go back and forth on it. That's kind of nice.
I can see the status of each drive and which one has a problem. I can go in here and I can specifically manage certain hard drives. I get their individual temperature status. I can pull up information about them. I can run smart tests on them. I can schedule sector tests from here. I can set up my iSCSI LUNs or targets here. I can enable a hot spare. And if I want to use one of the slots, now you have to give up one of your 4 slots. But if I want to, I can also install an SSD cache,
which
will give me even more of a performance boost. Now, remind you, I'm using 4 drives in their hybrid RAID. I'm getting, on average, about 95 megabytes a second when I write to it. That, for me, is about as good as you're going to get on a single Ethernet connection. So that's pretty good. And what really gets crazy about this thing is when you want to go in and set up some of your file shares and things like that, you bring up the control panel. Crazy easy. Now, this isn't Flash.
That's what I like about it.
This isn't Flash.
It's very, very clean.
I'm just using Chrome. It works in Firefox. It works in Safari. It works in everything. You go into your file sharing, is enable Windows file sharing, enable SMB2, enable local master browser. Click, 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 you're done. Mac file, enable Mac file services. Enable Bonjour printer broadcasting. Boy. NFS, you just check that NFS box, and now you have NFS. I mean, it is very, you jump in, you jump out. Setting up your users, extremely straightforward. You fill in the information. You can set up notifications via email. Oh, yeah.
It's like using OpenSUSE. It's like jumping into Yast and setting things up. I love that.
And keep in mind these user counts, because they're going to come back here in a little bit. Also, you can tie into LDAP and Active Directory, so you can join a domain from right here.
Right.
So you can, instead of using local accounts, you could use that. You can set up QoS. All the media indexing, VPN, that can actually support being a VPN endpoint.
Oh, no kidding.
Also has a built-in software updater, so you can go out and pull down the latest updates.
In fact,
it looks like I have an update available.
Oh.
So real easy to use. And again, you're not loading any software on your machine. You're just visiting this in a web page. And you notice, too, at the same time, over on the right-hand side, I have a real-time system status. I have my health, I have my CPU, my RAM, and my network transfer rate. Down here in the recent logs, this includes people who have logged in, people who have connected to the machine recently via one of the file services. So I can see here's a Windows file, here's an Apple file service connection.
Well, I like how everything's at a glance. You don't necessarily have to dive into all the deep stuff immediately. You can look at your general health on that control panel and get the general idea of what's going on just looking at it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I've left it up for a whole day while I was like copying files to it and just used it to see what my transfer rates were at. It has a built-in notification tray, so you can see when I hooked up the eSATA disk, I get a little notification here saying, hey, and I could actually eject that
device. Kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Here's my user control panel. I can search the device for files that are on the device. And then this is where it got crazy. Now, remember, this is Linux.
Sure.
It's running an Atom processor.
Mm-hmm.
So if it runs on an x86 Linux box, it could, in theory, run on this. Well, they've included what they're calling a package center.
Oh, no way.
It's like an app store for the Synology.
Awesome. Nice.
So I have a couple installed.
Okay.
The ones I installed are Glacier Backup. This backs up your Synology to Glacier. Amazon Glacier is Amazon's. It's like S3 only for long-term storage. It's a little cheaper.
Sure.
And so you can just go in here and add it, and then you pair it with your Amazon account, and then now the Synology itself will directly back up to Amazon Glacier, kind of like Jungle Disk, only using the more modern Amazon storage system that's meant for actual backup.
Wow.
I had a photo station, which I'll demo that in a minute. But there's a bunch of other really awesome apps that I was really surprised. Asterix is in here.
XBMC.
DocuWiki. Plex Media Server.
Oh, see, that's what I was going
for. So this thing could be a Plex Media Server directly.
Oh, seriously.
A Syslog server.
Wow.
Time Machine support. Tomcat web server.
Surveillance station?
Dude, would you see that? Where's the surveillance? Oh, yeah. So you got it. Oh, yeah.
Seriously, guys?
So check out the surveillance. Cool. Look at this. You get audio levels for your cameras. You get a time log. And all of this is being recorded to the Synology itself. You also get camera motion controls. You can move the camera around. And again, all being written to your Synology NAS, right? Mm. And it includes I don't know about Android, but they have an iOS app to view it. Multimedia. You can also be an iTunes server. Under business,
this is really
open
cool.
ERPs
WordPress.
On here.
Wow.
Moodle's on here. Sugar CRM you can install on this. A mail server. You can install MediaWiki.
Well, between the wiki, the CRM apps, and then the mail, I mean, it's like you're like small business ready right there.
PHP MyAdmin, DNS server, DHCP server. I mean, the list goes on, right? It's pretty impressive stuff they have in here. So I thought I'd demo you a couple of them that I have. So just like you'd expect, once you have an app installed, it goes into this start menu-like tray. So you see here I have Glacier Backup, so I can load this is the Glacier Backup program, and I can set up my backups and restore from here and view my log and all that kind of stuff.
Very clean.
And what's very nice about it is it just runs right on the Synology NAS itself. I don't have to have an external program doing this. And here is the photo station. Now, the photo station is really, really cool. It, as you might expect, allows you to take the photos that are on your NAS and give you a web UI to present them. And you get a very good UI to look at your pictures. You can share to social websites from here. You can share to like Facebook or Google Plus or Twitter.
So you can do the album or the individual photo.
Oh yeah. You can go in and so like here's this great beer butt chicken that I was making right.
Yeah.
Over on the side, you get your XF info. Like you can see, I took it on my HTC One. You can see what the f-stop was. It gives you all. Wow. If I had a GPS tag in there, you'd see it. So all that's in there. It's just a really nice way to view those pictures.
God, that's great.
But it gets even better.
Oh no, seriously!
I was surprised.
The surveillance stuff and all that.
I know, right?
That's awesome. It's like, oh my God.
They also have a series of Synology Android apps that work in tandem with these. On your Android device. So here is one of them. Here is the Synology Photo app.
Right.
This ties in with that Photo Station program. So using this app, I can view all of the photos that are in my Photo Station, and I can upload photos from my phone to the Photo Station.
Now, when you set this app up, what's the configuration like as far as being off your LAN? I mean, like, how's that work?
You would have to have you can see here, I just logged out so you can see it. Okay. You have to have either what they call a quick connect ID, which maybe is like through their service, or you'd have to have your IP exposed.
So you have the option of either or. If you're not comfortable exposing your IP, you can perhaps do it through them.
And it does SSL.
Oh,
so
that's important.
Yep.
Either way.
So this is you can take this photo station, which is on the Synology NAS, and you can manage it from your Android app. You can if you knew you had photos on there you wanted to show somebody, you could retrieve them that way, or if you knew you just took a great photo and you wanted to upload it to your Synology NAS, you could do it that way. Now, it gets even better. There's also an app that connects over WebDAV that lets you just access all of the files on the Synology NAS from your Android smartphone.
Very
so I have right here one of my video folders, and I have – here's Back to the Future. It's an MKV rip, right?
Okay.
And if I tap on it, it opens it up and says, well, just like in any other Android program, what program in Android do you want to use to watch this? I can choose whichever – I have several apps that are capable of playing MKV files on my Android phone, so I tell it which one I want. And within a few seconds, over WebDAV, that app goes out, connects to that MKV file, and now I am streaming Back to the Future in high definition on my HTC One from my Synology NAS.
It's like it's like Flex.
See, there's the hoverboard.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it is surprisingly easy. And once you put in the address of it, and there's several other apps that do this. They also, which I didn't bother installing, they have a Synology Download Manager that downloads torrents, FTP links, and Usenet files. And they have an Android app that lets you manage the download manager that's running on the Synology server.
Oh, I like the control. So this is multiple applications you can install on your Android phone to do multiple purposes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I kind of went light because I have Linux boxes that sit in front of my NAS server. They connect over NFS and they do a lot of this stuff. And I realized as I was kind of working on this is if I didn't have as stringent production demands, I really think that a lot of the stuff like running Plex, a photo server, running in your case like a security monitoring server, a lot of that could run on the Synology station. I don't have to have a dedicated server.
I wouldn't necessarily run them both at the same time, but I think just as an either or situation, absolutely.
At the end of the day, the thing that really impressed me about the Synology is they're not totally hiding the Linux from you. Mm-hmm. You can just check a box, turn on SSH, and then log in, and you have right here, it's BusyBox, but this is my Synology station. There's not a lot going on right now. But, this is the Synology server, and this is how I transferred the data, is I logged in, did an NFS mount to my existing FreeNAS server, mm-hmm. and then just used rsync to move all the data over right on the command line.
Boom.
And I had all the command line tools I expected to have, like rsync and top and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And right here on a Linux box, running kernel 3.240.
Yeah.
So new enough.
New enough and for what you need. It's stable.
I can see all the processes on here. So I understand how this works.
It doesn't treat you like you're stupid. It gives you enough control, but it can be easy if you want it to be.
Exactly. It's like this perfect balance of total easy to use mm-hmm. UI. Great performance. I mean, we're talking 95 megabytes a second. Not megabits, but megabytes a second.
That's decent.
Yeah. With built-in support for iSCSI, so when I build my Proxmox server, I can point it right at this thing. Wow. I'm pretty impressed. In fact, I'm so impressed that I think I'm going to tell them I want to keep it, and I'm going to pay full price for it.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'll move off of my FreeNAS installation to this. And that's, having my storage be based on BSD was kind of like, I'm a host Linux Action Show, and I'm using a BSD server.
Right.
And part of it was because I was being a ZFS bigot. But with their hybrid RAID technology, and the pluses of running Linux, it kind of to me works out to be a net positive.
Well, and you're getting the experience that you want, the collective overall general experience that you're looking for, not just based on this one individual technology, but the fact that the general experience is in fact really good.
Yeah, I look at this UI, right? I mean, like, how great is that?
Awesome! It's so clean,
and it's very. I thought. Oh, running something like this is going to have to put a ton of load on the box.
You would think, right?
Yeah. I was pounding it. When I was copying over terabytes and terabytes worth of data, I was streaming stuff from it. I was really trying out a whole bunch of stuff, mm-hmm. and it held solid. In fact, it's got a really nice resource monitor program in here where you go in here, you get your CPU, your memory utilization. You can look at the disk load. You can if you have iSCSI, it'll break that out for you. It gives you your network load. It charts it all out for you. Here's the processes. Current connections. Mm-hmm. I mean... And I can drop somebody. I can kill a connection.
That's cool, too. Because, let's say someone in the house needs to be dropped for whatever reason. Yeah. Maybe you're waiting for them to do something or they need to go do a chore or something. Bam, done.
The other really nice thing is it solves a lot of problems folks have when they're running a Samba server at home. Yes. Like, you have weird permission issues. They've ironed all of that out. And I'll give you an example. Like, you can go onto a share on this Synology box from a Windows client. And you can right-click on a folder in that share, and you can actually use the NT permissions dialog to set the permissions on the Samba server, and it translates those to the permissions they're supposed to be on the server. So Windows users who have used Windows all their life, who expect that kind of functionality, you have to go through the trouble on a Samba box of setting all that up. And then you got to make sure your creation masks are set properly. That way new files are created. This handles all of that. And it really sits in that sweet spot between advanced but yet easy enough to use.
So if you value your time, this is something you really consider.
And if you want performance,
yes.
And for me, I love the idea of that hybrid RAID. So I'm considering taking that external array, the drives for Jupyter array that we got, and plugging that into this.
Oh, right.
And then adding that to the storage pool. And then I'll just say, I'll take that. I have ideas to repurpose that FreeNAS box into a Proxmox server. And I'll hang it off of this. And then I have two Linux servers. I'm going to combine them onto the Proxmox service, shut those things down. Mm-hmm. This thing only pulls 44 watts, and it has intelligent power management, so it'll spin the fans down if it doesn't need them. It can spin the drives down if they haven't been accessed for a certain amount of time.
That's good for the life of the drive.
Yeah, and then I'll have a Proxmox box sitting in front of it doing some of the more advanced, fancy features that I want. But the solid performance of this thing, and because it is kind of simple, the design is kind of simple, mm-hmm. it's pretty straightforward, and the whole it gives you like individual drive temperatures mm-hmm. and health. So I really I've had problems with drives dying on me
and not knowing why or seeing the warning signs. Or even, this is going to take care
or
of
or even like in the case of the FreeNAS server, sometimes I don't even know which drive.
Oh, right.
Like, I just
it's
know,
not identified as a specific drive. It's just identified, hey, you're having problems.
Yeah, drive 8001 is having problems. And
what
I'm like,
what the hell does that mean?
Yeah, which drive is 8001 in this whole list here? And it's kind of like this and what I've literally had to do in FreeNAS is I pull a drive and I wait to see drive 802 was removed. Okay, that's not the right drive. I put it back in. I pull the next drive, 803. Okay, that's not the right drive.
But this addresses that. This gives you
each drive has been numbered in the chassis, and then in the UI, it correlates all of the health information to that specific drive. So now I know, okay, drive 3 is specifically having an issue. Go pull drive 3. And then you add drive 3 and automatically rebuilds the array. And I kind of – ZFS might be my preference, but at the same time, EXT4 is a tried and true file system. It has fantastic performance,
sure.
And I intimately know how to work with it. And I know how to take it, hook it up to my Bonobo through the eSATA port, and maybe pull something off of it. So I'm a little more comfortable with EXT4. Plus, I'm a little more comfortable with the fact that it's Linux, too.
Sure. Absolutely.
And so there you go. So if you're watching the video version, you kind of see how the drive slides in and slides out. Real super easy to use. It just snaps right in. It comes with a little tray that's really easy to install them. Mm. And I've had it running next to me, like while we were doing Linux Unplugged, and it's silent.
That's a big thing right there, especially in a studio environment.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeesh. So that's the disk station from Synology. This is the DS412. Oh, I should probably, you know, they sent this was a review unit, so I didn't actually look at the price. The price... It starts, of course, with all this kind of stuff. There's a few ways you can buy it, right? You can buy it empty.
Yeah, right.
With no drives.
Which, for me, I would just want the drives included.
Yeah, and then if you want the drives included, on Amazon, the unit itself is 600 bones. But it's a full-fledged PC.
But you're getting a lot. I mean, I was going to say, you're getting a lot of value for it.
And then if you go like with their 12 terabyte bundled, which comes with Reds, it gets up to 1,500. See, for me... I already have the drive. If I didn't have the drives from Jupiter's, then I would probably not be able to make the switch.
Oh,
because I already have the
drives. That'd be 1,500 bones.
Yeah, I already have the drives. So $600 for me, because I'm going to use it in my business, I'm going to use it constantly. I mean, I really use the hell out of our disk storage. It's totally worth
it. The value weighs in. Yeah.
Totally. And plus, I want to repurpose that FreeNAS box as a Proxmox server. I've been wanting to do that for a while, so this gives me an opportunity to do that. And you can see here's the packaging. It's pretty minimal.
Yeah. They did a nice job, and the icon set is very reflective of the experience that you get in the web GUI.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's got, they're the same icon, so it's very all tied together. Yeah. It's got a lot of backup programs I didn't dig into. There's not just backing up the unit itself. It's also got sync programs to sync with your desktop program. They list Ubuntu 9 and later as supported. And it's got features to do like imaging. It's got features to back up Max using Time Machine.
Love it.
Lots of stuff in there. But for me, the core things came down to Linux-powered, x86-based. That, for me, is important.
Yeah.
And Linux, fast. Performance, very Linux, fast. And x86.
Can take a licking and keep on ticking.
So that is the Synology box. And I say, if you're in the market, pick one up.
And that brings us to the end of this week's broadcast. Hey, Matt.
Yes.
Before we go, should we read some emails?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just wanted to... couple of quick things, follow-ups. I think I said this in the review, but I have done a 180. When that Synology arrived at my house, I thought, this is a toy, right? Because I've worked
Your initial impression without having tried it yet, sure.
Matt, you should see some of the data centers where I've worked where the storage, like we've had racks and racks and racks of storage. And that wasn't enough. So when I saw this little box show up, I thought, there's no way.
It's adorable.
Yeah. It's a cute toy.
Yeah.
And then I'll play with the toy and then I'll send it back. Right?
Sure.
I did a 180. I was pretty impressed. And I just wanted to say, we'll have a link to it in the show notes. If you pick that up using the link in the show notes, you'll support the show. And because it's a high-ticket item, we'll get a nice cut from that. So
nice.
We appreciate that. All right, Matt, here's our first email. It came from Sam. And Sam says, he wants to know about Linux for the older generations. He says, hi, Chris and Matt. With the end of support for Windows XP coming about, my father is trying to decide which OS to move to. He's well aware that Microsoft has long been a sinking ship and is quite prepared to hop on the Linux bandwagon. However... he is very old-fashioned, liking things simple and stable. Why he never upgraded past XP, by the way. His memory is taking a hit, and as he gets older, and although he is very technically capable, he is worried that he will never fully familiarize with Linux and things won't, quote-unquote, stick. He doesn't want to be a pain by asking me questions all the time, and likewise, I don't want him to be trying to do his own banking one day and get stuck, and I'm not contactable. Simple is better. Mm-hmm. So, with your wide experiences of mini distros... which would you say is the most suited for the older generation? Most people would say Ubuntu, but I have not been a fan of Canonical lately. Thanks for making a great show, Sam.
So here's the deal. First and foremost, above anything, is you want an ability to remote into a desktop. Keeping in mind, I used to run a PC repair business, and when I exited that PC repair business, I actually migrated half my customer base over to Linux, so I didn't have to deal with it anymore. And it worked out really well, actually. And then set them up with someone else to take over after that. So based on that, I have some experience in this, and I would say you're going to want a desktop experience either based on Debian or, I hate to say it, probably Ubuntu, that is going to allow you to do that. Now, that being said, you don't want to use Unity. That I Google Chris Perillo's dad tries to use Ubuntu, and you'll understand why. Doesn't work. So what you're going to want to do is you're going to want something like XFCE, probably, something simple. What he's using, everything needs to be on the desktop, browser, preferably email browser. The bookmarks need to be actually below the address bar itself so that everything's readily accessible.
What about Linux Mint with Cinnamon? Cinnamon's kind of a lot like
check
XP.
Check it for stability because Linux Mint's hit and miss. Yeah, I would say Linux Mint's a good choice. Make sure it's stable before you actually release it. And make sure you can remote in.
Hey, what about, do you remember when we reviewed Zorin OS?
And Zorin's not a bad option.
One of the things about Zorin was that it had like this menu you could bring up and say, what UI do you want us to be like? And one of the options was you could choose XP, and then it would kind of set up an XP theme.
And that is Ubuntu based, right?
If it is, then as long as you can 1204 based, I think.
As long as you can get a remote app in there to where you can remote in, because you're going to still have that happen. And I forget what was the app.
See, look at this right here. So you got Windows 7, Windows XP, Windows 2000, and you click that, and it uses the menu, and then you have the browser chooser too.
Whoa, yeah, right.
This is probably.
There you go.
This probably is. And Zorin OS, like you said, it's Ubuntu based, so that's going to solve some of the software compatibility.
That would be a good approach. But yeah, I mean, go Zorin OS and just keep it simple. Less is more.
And then what? Maybe Splashtop for remote access?
Splashtop would be, that's what I would do just because it's minimal. You can just leave it running in the background.
Yeah.
Or the
Chrome remote desktop works
Chrome's
under Linux
not bad.
Too.
Yeah, that's not bad. Either one would work okay. Something to where he doesn't have to worry about forwarding ports or any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so, no kidding.
I've been through that.
Splashtop might be easier. On you as the supportee.
It would, and it works really, really well. It's stable. It's not going to do any weird stuff.
If you're out and about, you could at least pull up his screen on your smartphone and at least see what he's talking about.
Absolutely.
Right? That's the nice thing there about it.
Because common instances is maybe they're wanting to use bill payer with banking or stuff like that. These are things you really need to just sometimes be there to actually see what they're seeing. And so it's helpful.
Yeah, they call it the look changer.
And I like that name because it's exactly
so
what
here
it
is. So here's the XP look. Here I'm pulling up. Oh, wow. They even do the XP style menu. Look at that, where they have
This is. I'm gonna have to look into this more seriously for some folks. Actually,
yeah. That's I remember really when we looked good. At this. I remember you and I said this was like the Windows switcher, the Windows salvation. They have a Windows 7.
I mean, it's
style
not for
too.
Me as a power user, but I think for just Joe average, that just right?
And here's the Windows 2000 look, which is
because I mean there are other things. Yeah, sure, you could go Mate or Cinnamon or whatever, but I think actually identifying with something they're familiar with more heavily is going to save you some hassle if you're the support guy.
Zorin OS.
Wow.
Check it out.
Seriously.
All right. So Noah writes in. Noah writes in. He wants to take the Linux community to task. He says, you're missing the point with Ubuntu. I normally don't comment about this stuff, but the Ubuntu hate has me all wound up.
Okay.
Yes, Ubuntu has its problems, but I think we're all missing the point. First, mobile on the desktop is not the issue.
Okay.
What you, meaning the Linux community, are missing is that Ubuntu is a general purpose distro, and it always has been. The only difference is the shift in the meaning of the general purpose. You are power users that need powerful machines, but most users are using tablets and phones because they play mindless games and browse the net. That brings me to my second point. I think he's kind of I wonder if that's actually true. I wonder if the majority of computer users, like outside of techies, are just people at an office.
Depends
desk.
On the generational. I'd say 40 and under, yes. I'd say 50 and over, probably still desktops and laptops. And at home.
Yeah.
Home. Not in business, but at home. That's been my experience. I know entire households that are reasonably tech savvy that have not; they don't have a single laptop or otherwise.
Yeah, you know, I feel like we've been. I feel like a certain portion out there is branded as Ubuntu haters. When both before the show on the live stream, our Ubuntu 13.10 review was playing, and we had a lot of good things to say.
Yeah, we did. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't suck. It actually is usable.
Yeah,
it needs to do.
I think people need to reconsider that. We're not Ubuntu haters. We're just.
I run Ubuntu as a secondary computer.
Yeah, I have several Ubuntu machines in the house. So it's
just saying, you know.
We're just asking critical questions.
Didn't like it, I wouldn't use it.
This brings him to a second point: the scopes.
Sure.
The general population can barely distinguish local and cloud services. Smart scopes and the relay of information to Canonical may bother you, but it's meaningless to the average user.
That last part I agree with. It does bother me, and it is meaningless to the average user because I'm God. Do already.
Yeah. So. I would argue, though, that outside of all the privacy stuff, it's also a bad implementation that delivers poor results
that's the part the user might care about.
Is generally underwhelming. So I think most people just won't use it.
That's probably what's going to happen.
says, not to mention you are quick to have Android take some of that information without so much of a fuss, which
me more than Chris. Chris is actually quite critical of it. I'm not. I'm pretty lackadaisical about it. But you've actually voiced some concerns about, hey, I'm not cool with this. Yeah. You know.
Says that brings me to my final point. We are no longer competing with Microsoft, and those that continue to do so will die on that sinking ship. That's funny. Yeah. Both emails called Microsoft a sinking ship. I do agree with that. I think focusing on Microsoft is placing the energy in the wrong spot.
Greed.
He said Android is now the most popular OS on the planet, and this is our new arch enemy. This can be seen with Ubuntu entrance into mobile, as well as GNOME Shell and Plasma Active. Every year, someone will write an article about Linux is how it's behind other platforms, yet when one company makes efforts to play on the same field, you chastise them for breaking away from the cluster fudge that is the Linux desktop. Ubuntu has brought more eyes to Linux than any distro, and maybe, just maybe, they're crazy enough to make it work.
I think that I agree with them bringing more eyes to the desktop. I don't know how their long game's going to turn out. I have concerns. There was a time there were other distributions, Xandros, Linspire, amongst a couple of other ones that are lesser known that tried the same thing that people said the same thing about. It's easy to make a mistake that can really sink a ship. And so I think it's still too early to say for sure.
Yeah,
I don't know. I really hope they're successful. I do.
As I read this, I definitely see some points he's making here. I think what it comes down to is execution.
Yeah. And I think it was really well thought out. There's some stuff I take issue with, but overall I think the general consensus of the email itself is pretty spot on.
Mm-hmm. We've had some people asking us to review Ubuntu Touch 1.0. I think we'll wait.
Give it a little more time in the oven so we can give a bit. Because I don't want to just rip on it. Yeah. Oh my God. I want to actually show off the things they're trying
Ubuntu
to do.
Ubuntu Touch 1.0 did ship last week with 13.10. And it's definitely at a spot now where developers should be digging into it. I don't know if it's really at a spot where critical review should be.
There you go.
You know, it
calling it alpha doesn't seem fair because I want to give it more time in the oven.
I mean, we could totally do a tech demo at some point.
Oh, totally. Yeah, like with absolutely no opinion on performance, just like here's some things they're doing. This
but we've
cool.
done that. Yeah, we did look at it a while ago.
Yeah, we did kind of. Yeah. Need some stuff on it first.
But with all of this stuff, I kind of just like to sit back and see. The thing is Linux will not die. From one popular distro going off on their own tangent and trying something.
Nope.
And there is more to be gained by watching what happens there and observing and taking what works and applying it to the rest of the community and discarding what doesn't work. And in the long run, I'm talking like the 5-year perspective here. It seems impossible now, but it's going to make Linux stronger. It's going to make open source offerings better.
It will.
And maybe they'll be wildly successful with it. And maybe they won't. In the grand picture, Linux is already won, because companies do not last forever, right? Microsoft will not; they're already losing their dominance.
Yeah, Navy ships that once ran Windows are now running Linux and doing so with gusto.
And 8.1 doesn't solve this.
No,
9 probably won't either. Right, Windows 9 probably won't either. We've all seen the rumors that Apple might switch to an ARM-based laptop. That if they jettisoned Intel compatibility. That would be devastating for Apple's market share.
I'm
on
waiting
the
for Microsoft BSD. I've been saying it for years, and I've been right about the stuff for the most part.
They had a Unix based OS long time ago.
Bill Gates actually talked up BSD at one point. So I know he's not. I know that the company isn't totally adverse to the idea, and I think it'd be interesting to see if they do that.
There's nothing that Canonical can do to break the laws of physics. Eventually, Linux has taken over. The phone, it's taken over the networking space. It's essentially, like Linus said in an interview, Linux is dominating every single general computing platform except for the desktop. And that is not because it never will. That's just because there's been other offerings that for a lot of people were better alternatives for various reasons. Those reasons will begin to diminish. They already are diminishing. We're watching it happen. We're watching the collapse of the standard desktop monopoly. The general computing platform, which has dominated every other computing platform, cloud, mobile, etc., networking gear, etc., will eventually dominate the desktop. It's a matter of physics. It's like an expanding universe. Eventually, it'll get there.
Just wait
certain things
right
slow
steward.
It down, maybe, but it's going in that direction.
Well, I think we have
happen.
Different stewards to go different directions with it. We're just waiting on the right steward to take it the direction it needs to go.
It'd be like going back and watching the early Neanderthals and things like that, and critiquing the evolution of the Neanderthal when not having any idea what they'd eventually develop into, right?
That's a very good point.
Open source is, for better or for worse, is very organic in its nature. And sometimes, the beast goes off in a different direction, and then eventually evolution corrects that path, and we move back to the correct direction.
Basically, open source is a bunch of very passionate, loud little monkey people in a maze. And they're going to kill each other going throughout the whole maze, but eventually they're going to get to the end of that maze. They're just going to be some blood and fur.
Open source is made of people, Matt. As we've definitely...
Monkeys!
Yeah, as we've definitely discovered, sometimes those monkeys fling poo, and sometimes they make incredible
code. You're looking at
code.
The big monkey right here. I when it comes to flinging poo, I am your master.
Well, Matt, is there anywhere you want to send people throughout the week between shows?
Well, I'd be sending you there, but I definitely...
Not yet.
But yeah, you can definitely check out the Matt Hartley Public at Facebook, so you can check that out.
Very
and
good.
For now, that's probably your best bet. There's some stuff coming, not quite ready yet.
Of course, also, you got to check out one of the greatest Linux podcasts on the planet.
Linux Unplugged.
Linux Unplugged every Tuesday over at JupiterBroadcasting.com. Episode 10. 10 weeks in a row, Matt.
Yes.
Just popped. And people are loving the Unplugged. So if you want more Linux, go get Linux Unplugged. Don't forget, too, one of the ways you can keep us on the air is by using our browser extension. Yes. You can find that link at the bottom of Jupiter Broadcasting. You can get it for Chrome, Firefox. You can also search other browser marketplaces. But we have those linked at the bottom of the site. When you use those and you shop, especially with the holidays coming up, a portion of your shopping session is contributed to Jupiter Broadcasting. It doesn't cost you anymore. It's a way to give yourself something and give us a little something. And we use that to defer costs like our bandwidth, our gear, and things like that.
It keeps us on the air. And even if you have it installed, make sure it's updated. And keep it in mind.
Active.
Yeah, and active. And if you're shopping already, hey, why not?
And if you're on a machine that doesn't have it, we have a lot of the popular ones linked at the bottom of every page on Jupiter Broadcasting, like Amazon and Newegg and Best Buy. You click those before you shop, it does the same
you're
thing.
At work, you don't want to install a plugin. That's the perfect way to go.
Shame on you. I mean, yes.
Yes, you should be on LA. You need to be watching LAS from work. That's important.
Absolutely. We also want to hear from you. You can go over to JupiterBroadcasting.com and click that contact link and then choose Linux Action Show in the drop-down, or even better, start a thread in our subreddit over at linuxactionshow.reddit.com. That's also where you can submit stories, comment on stories. Yep. We use all of that content over there. Heavily influences this show.
It does.
And it's part of the open source process that is this very podcast.
Wow.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning in this week's episode of the Linux Action Show. We'll see you right back here next week. Anto! And welcome.
Hi.
I hit my microphone. Yeah, man. Oh, yeah, man. Let's play season two. Okay, so based on those early results, I'd say that Cinnamon has a dominant lead by 70% of the vote. So we'll be doing Cinnamon Review next week. So I could have talked about this. DS Download is another app, as the name implies. Oh, I did talk about this. This is the download manager. So say like there's something you're browsing the web on your phone, you're like, shit, I'd really like to download that, but I don't want to download it on my phone.
Exactly.
You can use this to send the download job to the Synology box.
And
then the Synology
seriously?
Box will download it.
Dude.
Yeah. All right, coming up on this week's episode of the Linux Action Show, we're going to review a Synology NAS that runs Linux and has a few surprises in the box. We'll tell you all about that. I was expecting a ladies' NAS, and I got a man's NAS.
Wow!